Good evening. The military faces the pandemic in their own ranks. The ACLU demands freedom for immigration detainees as the disease is discovered in an ICE prison in New Jersey. And the great influenza, what can be learned from the 1918 flu pandemic? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Thursday, March 26, 2020. The human and economic toll of the lockdowns against the coronavirus mounted Thursday. India struggled to feed the multitudes. Italy shut down most of its industry, and a record-shattering 3.3 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits in a single week. The number of infections worldwide reached 500,000, and deaths climbed to about 23,000. India's 1.3 billion people were under orders to stay home, throwing legions of poor out of work, leaving many families struggling for food. The death toll rose to about 8,200 in Italy, 4,100 in Spain, and 1,700 in France, including a 16-year-old. The United States had more than 1,000 deaths, about 400 of them in New York State. Louisiana was quickly becoming another smoldering hotspot. The number of new cases there jumped by more than 500 Thursday, surpassing 2,300, with 86 deaths, including a 17-year-old. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards requested a major disaster declaration for the state Tuesday, which was approved by Trump. In Brazil, the country's governors are defying President Jair Bolsonaro over his call to reopen schools and businesses. They're dismissing his arguments that the cure of widespread shutdowns is worse than the disease. As of Thursday, Brazil had more than 2,500 cases and 59 deaths. Meanwhile, from Fifth Avenue to London's Piccadilly Circus to the boulevards of Paris and the streets of Rome and Madrid, restaurants, hotels, airlines, giant chains, and small shops are all shuttered. Factories have ground to a halt, and cities, states, and entire countries have ordered people to stay home. The United States military has not been immune to the virus, with hundreds of cases. Army Chief of Staff General James McConville had this to say.
This morning, the Army has 288 confirmed cases of COVID-19, 100 are soldiers, 64 are Department of the Army civilians, 65 are dependents, 9 are cadets, and 50 are Army contractors. This week, the Secretary of Defense signed orders for 3 Army hospitals to deploy to New York and Washington State, the 531st Hospital from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and the 9th Hospital from Fort Hood, Texas, will deploy to New York City. An advance party is on the ground as I speak. The main body will arrive at Joint Base McGuire, Dix, Lakehurst tomorrow. They will set up at the Javits Center this weekend, and they will be operational for non-COVID patients beginning Monday. The 627th Hospital from Fort Carson, Colorado, will deploy to Seattle. An advance party arrived yesterday evening. They are coordinating with state and local authorities and conducting a site survey of the CenturyLink field in a state fairground, and a location decision is pending. Our Army Corps of Engineers is engaged in all 50 states, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, assisting FEMA and state authorities. They are on the ground conducting site assessments for alternate care facilities. Lieutenant General Semonite will provide a detailed press briefing on the Corps Engineers' efforts tomorrow. Over 10,000 National Guard soldiers are supporting COVID-19 response efforts in communities in every state across the nation. Their missions include delivering food to communities, supporting local emergency management agencies, providing personal protective equipment to first responders and hospital personnel, providing support to testing facilities, providing transportation for health care workers, cleaning and disinfecting public spaces, and staffing call centers to inform the public. Yesterday, the Army G1, Lieutenant General Tom Siemens, reached out to retired officers, non-commissioned officers, and soldiers who have the skills and expertise to assist with our COVID-19 response efforts. This is an involuntary voluntary opportunity for our medical soldiers for life to return to the fight if they so choose, especially if they are not currently assisting their local communities. So far, the initial responses have been very, very positive. Also yesterday, the Army directed all installations to assume health protection condition level Charlie. HEPCOM Chali includes all previous guidance on personal hygiene, social distancing, disinfecting common areas, and having 14 days of supplies on hand. It also gives commanders more authority to restrict access to our installations and limit that access to mission essential personnel. Our immediate response forces have assumed HEPCOM Delta to remain ready to respond to threats, just like we saw with the 82nd Airborne Division in January. We are meeting the Secretary of Defense's intent by protecting the force and supporting the national response effort. We are standing up to prevent, to detect, and treat COVID-19. This is a tough fight, but together we'll do our part to help the nation win. Mr. Secretary.
In related news, the military says it will stop providing some data about coronavirus infections within its ranks. Officials are concerned the information might be used by enemies as the virus spreads. Thousands of military personnel are in quarantine or in self-isolation in Europe and the Middle East due to exposure or recent travel to high-risk locations. Yesterday, the Pentagon confirmed a U.S. Marine stationed at the Department of Defense has tested positive for the coronavirus. That's the first case at the military headquarters, where 22,000 work. As the coronavirus spreads across the nation and the world, a group of the most vulnerable and scorned is facing a growing threat. Immigration and customs enforcement detention facilities across the country have seen protests, hunger strikes, and violent confrontations, the most recent in Louisiana and Texas, as ICE detainees say they're facing sickness and death. On Monday, migrants clashed with guards over a lack of safe conditions and demanded to be released from the South Texas Processing Center in Pearsall, run by the private GEO Group under contract with ICE. Yesterday in Louisiana, seven people were pepper sprayed at the Pine Prairie Detention Center, also run by the GEO Group. Reportedly, detainees are using water to try to clean their area, fearful that if one migrant catches the virus, it could quickly spread to others. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit against ICE demanding the release of detainees who are at most risk from the coronavirus. Eunice Cho is a senior staff attorney for the ACLU. She spoke with WBAI earlier today.
We have reports that immigrant detainees have had a very difficult time obtaining the basic things that they need to protect themselves against COVID-19, including things like soap, sanitizer, water. And of course, these are immigrant detainees know that they're in great danger of risk with respect to COVID-19. They've said, we feel like we're sitting ducks. And what we know about immigration detention facilities is that conditions are not good to begin with. Medical care is substandard to begin with. And there are multiple reports across facilities with respect to the use of force by guards. Put those all together and you have a disaster in the making. You have people who are scared for their lives, guards who are underpaid, undertrained, and under capacity with a medical care system that is not set up to deal with medical care needs in a normal time, let alone a pandemic. And so the reports that we've been hearing are there's hunger strikes in facilities. There are reports of tear gas happening when people are asking for the things that they need to survive.
What is the scope of the problem? I mean, how many people are being held? Where are they being held? How many of these facilities are there? What are they like?
Approximately 40,000 people who are being held in immigration detention centers across the country. These facilities are a mix of large immigration detention facilities that hold about 1,500 people at a time to smaller jails where immigrants are being held in contract facilities where the government contracts with these jails. And we know that people in these facilities are trying to get out, especially those who are at serious risk of illness and death because of COVID-19.
Are you calling for these people to be released? Is there any hope of that happening?
What we're calling for in our litigation against the government is for ICE to release people who are at serious risk of illness and death because of COVID-19. Everything we know about COVID-19 is that there is no vaccine, there's no cure, there's no treatment. And the only thing that people can do to protect themselves from COVID-19 is to do what everybody else is doing, which is practicing good hygiene and social distancing. Those things are virtually impossible to do when you're in immigration detention. And so the only way that we can prevent lethal infection from a disease that has no cure is to let people out of detention and practice those same things.
Let me ask you about children and families that are being held in these camps. And we saw the pictures of children in cages. Is that still going on? And how does the health of these children being affected?
We are particularly concerned concerned about people who are at risk of danger of COVID. And, you know, everything that we know is that there are people with medical conditions who are older people who are particularly vulnerable to COVID. And immigration detention centers hold people of all ages. Children, we've seen infants in detention centers and the family detention centers that ICE has set up. I've seen elderly people in wheelchairs being held in immigration detention center. This is not the way it needs to be. ICE, what needs to really needs to begin a practice of comprehensively making sure that people who are vulnerable to COVID are safe.
What happens to people when they get sick in the jail? I mean, in New York State, what's happening when they need ventilators and when people get sick in these detention centers? What happens to them?
That's something that we're frightened to find out the news, what will happen. We know that people in jails and prisons are in what they call congregate environments. These are environments where people are together, breathing, living in the same air. And the reason that public health officials have called for ICE to release people from detention is because of what we know has happened in the first phase of this disease, the cruise ships, the nursing homes where people are in these environments where you can't actually exercise social distancing. What will happen is basically people will all get sick at the very same time. And what that does is places a huge burden on terms of a already overburdened healthcare infrastructure. And what we're trying to do is prevent certain disaster as a result of that.
So they bring people to whatever the local hospital is if they get sick.
If there's room.
I've seen situations where they chain people to the bed and things like that. Is that what they're going to do? I mean,
if you ever read the contracts that ICE has with local facilities, you'll see that what is required under these contracts when people are sent to hospitals is that they are under security watch. And it is a question as to whether or not this is actually even needed given this particular context.
Where things are at legally right now and where they're going.
The ACLU has sued ICE in a number of different states, including Washington, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. We have a few more suits coming down the pipeline. And what we have seen is that ICE is starting to release some people that we have named in our lawsuits before the courts can make a decision as to whether or not it's unconstitutional to be holding people in these circumstances given COVID-19. What we hope is that ICE takes this seriously and that it sees the writing on the wall and that it will do what we all believe is the right thing to do, which is for the good of our community, for the good of people who are in detention, make sure that people who are at high risk of serious illness and death because of COVID can be let out, and let's avoid this humanitarian disaster in the making.
Eunice Cho is a senior staff attorney for the ACLU. In New Jersey detention facilities, four people, two correctional officers and two detainees have tested positive for COVID-19. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In New York State, the number of people suffering from COVID-19 continues to grow. As of Thursday morning, at least 385 people in the state have died from coronavirus. According to Governor Andrew Cuomo, some COVID-19 deaths have now been on COVID-19 patients have now been on ventilators for between 20 to 30 days. Cuomo added, the longer a patient is on a ventilator, the less likely the individual would survive. Cuomo has said that the state needs 30,000 ventilators to handle the anticipated wave of coronavirus patients in the next 3 weeks.
Any scenario that is realistic will overwhelm the capacity of the current healthcare system. So, little reality. Keep the curve down as low as you can. But you cannot get the curve down low enough so that you don't overwhelm the hospital capacity. So any of these scenarios, we have to increase the hospital capacity. And that's why we're literally adding to the hospital capacity every way we can. That's what the Javits Hospital is about. That's what the Stony Brook Hospital is about. That's what Westchester Convention Center, that's what the old Westbury additional site is. We're also scouting new sites now all across primarily the downstate area of this state for possible sites. Our goal is to have a 1,000 plus overflow facility in each of the boroughs downstate in the counties. Ventilators, ventilators, ventilators. I didn't know what they were a few weeks ago. Besides the cursory knowledge, I know too much about ventilators now. We're still shopping for ventilators all across the country. We need more. We have approved a technology that allows one ventilator to serve two patients, what they call splitting, which is where you add a second set of tubes to a ventilator to do two patients. It's not ideal, but we believe it's workable. We're also converting anesthesia machines to ventilators. If somebody's on a ventilator for 3 or 4 days, that's one level of ventilators you need. If somebody's on for 11 to 21 days, that's a totally different equation. And that's what we're dealing with. The high number of COVID patients and the long period of time that they actually need a ventilator.
Governor Andrew Cuomo speaking earlier on Thursday. As reported earlier, nearly 3.3 million people filed for unemployment benefits last week. It's an unprecedented number, reflecting only the beginning of the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Since the government began tracking applications, the most claims filed in a single week had been fewer than 700,000 in 1982. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., lawmakers are quickly shifting their attention to a Phase 4 coronavirus bill. Congress is set to pass a $2.2 trillion stimulus package, historically the nation's largest, as soon as Friday, as lawmakers try to ward off a deep recession sparked by the outbreak. But leadership says more legislation will be needed. Already, Governor Cuomo has blasted the stimulus bill as falling far short of his state's needs. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi addressed the governor's concern on Thursday. She says her main effort was to prevent Republicans from foisting what she called a tax scam on Americans.
And I have the enormous respect for him. I think he's doing a spectacular job at what he is doing. And it's something we've never seen before. But I also see that with my own governor, Gavin Newsom in California. They remind me of each other in terms of they're so values based and they're determined to do the right thing and respecting the dignity and worth of every person. So it's not a question of bailing out states. It's a question of meeting the needs of the people. And that's our responsibility to do. He called it a drop in the bucket. Well, it's several billion dollars, and it isn't anywhere near enough, but it's still several billion, I think like 5.6 billion, something for New York. We have to do more. And if we don't face that reality, and we're encouraging the states then to give money to localities as well, because they, in our situation, California, for example, San Francisco provides a lot of the cities and counties provide a lot of the care throughout the country and meeting the needs, whatever they are, on a public health issue. So there's no question that more money will be needed. Last night and what we will do tomorrow, $2 trillion is about the cost of the tax scam that the Republicans foisted on the nation to give 83% of the benefits to the top 1%, whatever it was, plus the interest on the loan, on the debt. Indebting our kids and their future, paying the bill for tax breaks for the high end. Said it was going to pay for itself. It never does. Said it was going to create jobs. It didn't. However, this is an emergency, a challenge to the conscience as well as the budget of our country. And every dollar that we spend is an investment in the lives and the livelihood of the American people. We can go bigger, especially now the interest rates are even lower than at the time of the tax scam.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, today was Pelosi's 80th birthday. Lawmakers have already written three coronavirus response bills. The first was $8.3 billion. The second was $104 billion. And the latest is estimated to be $2.2 trillion. Now, how a fourth bill will come together and what will be included in it is still up for debate. And as the pandemic has gripped the world, some have been looking at history to see how previous outbreaks of deadly disease affected our predecessors. One of the biggest medical calamities in world history occurred in 1918 when Europe was consumed by the Great War, what we usually call World War I. The influenza outbreak was never traced. It was called Spanish flu at the time. Spain had been neutral in the war. Others say it started among farmers in Kansas. The fact is, we'll never know. John Barry is author of The Great Influenza, a book about the disease that killed between 50 and 100 million people in less than 6 months.
know what a virus was, whether it was a really small bacteria or a different kind of organism. The hypothesis was that it was that influenza was caused by a particular bacteria, which obviously was mistaken, but they certainly knew it was an infectious disease. We were at war. Everything in every politician pretty much in the federal government was focused entirely on the war. Therefore, in order to keep morale up, I say that somewhat sarcastically, the government lied to the American people, pretended this was nothing serious. They called it, said it was ordinary influenza by another name. It was known as Spanish flu. People knew they were being lied to. That broke down all sorts of trust. You know, places that were hardest hit, the society itself began to fray. In terms of the actions they took, they're very similar to what's going on today. You know, banning public gatherings and so forth, closing schools and businesses. As a general rule, they did that too late. They did it after the virus was already pretty widely disseminated in the community. So it didn't have significant effect. The social distancing measures are going to have any real impact. They need to be taken early when the virus first begins community transmission.
Is there such a thing as a nationally oriented virus?
Obviously, there is no national pride in the fact that in wherever some virus from an animal courses into the humans, it can happen anywhere in the world. 2009 was either Mexico, probably, but it actually might have occurred in San Diego, where some of the first cases were actually found. That is clearly an effort to fit it into his political construct and maybe make some benefit so he could blame someone else.
The pandemic of 1918 killed many, many millions of people. There were reports, you know, I read in your book and I've seen since that there was a belief that almost everybody on Earth could die. I mean, nobody knew how far this would go.
Correct.
How did it come to an end, and how does that parallel how things might come to an end here?
Essentially, it would burn through a community, infect everybody who is vulnerable, move on. It wouldn't completely disappear. There were several waves. Finally, partly probably, though this is not crystal clear, but probably the virus mutated in direction of most influenza viruses toward more mildness. It's actually a pretty nasty virus under any circumstances, but nothing like the 1918 virus normally. In addition, people's immune systems became much more able to deal with it when they saw it come around again and again, kind of faded out. Something like that, I think, is very likely to happen here.
The president saying, well, let's get things going by Easter if it looks like it's going down. In New York, they said it looks like the social distancing is working the last few days. It's been, you know, flattening the curve a little bit as they tried to do. But there's always a possibility it could come back. It never goes away entirely, right?
That's about right, yeah.
So it's a little foolish to jump in there and say it's over when it's just the first time it diminishes a little bit.
We're very early in this. And we will be at Easter.
John Barry is author of The Great Influenza, about the disease that killed between 50 and 100 million in less than 6 months in the year 1918. And finally, in a poignant moment during his news conference today, Governor Cuomo reflected on the pandemic. He says this generation of young people will be facing existential adversity for the first time in generations, an experience to last a lifetime.
You think about our children. I have my daughters here with me. This is the first time they've faced a real national adversity, right? Oh, you have a whole new generation who have never lived through anything like this. They never went to war. They were never drafted. They never went through a national crisis. And this is going to shape them. And I can tell you just from having my daughters with me, yeah, they're hurt, they're scared, but they are also learning through this. And at the end of the day, they're going to be better people for it, and they're going to be better citizens for it. I believe that, because they're rising to the occasion. And as we go through this, let's make sure that we're teaching them the right lessons and the right response. And those lessons and that response are the lessons that we get from our better angels. And during this difficult time, let's listen to the voices of our better angels. as individuals, as families, as a community, and as a society. We're going to get through this. The only question is how we get through it and when we get through it. But let's make sure at the end of the day that we can say we are the better for it. And our children are the better for it. And I believe they will.
Governor Andrew Cuomo. And that's some of the news for Thursday, March 26th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.